ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। हरिः ॐ श्रीगुरुभ्यो नमः। हरिः ॐ। Hello, everybody, and a very, very happy new year, happy and healthy new year to all of you. So in this new year, we are beginning a new text, not only a new text, but as far as my memory goes, I think this is the first Upanishad that we are doing in the Calgary class, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is the first time that we're taking up an Upanishad for study. So before we actually go into the text proper, we must understand what exactly an Upanishad is. So today I'm only going to basically introduce the text. And if so, we won't go enter into the text, because we need to understand what the Upanishad is, what an Upanishad is, or what the Upanishad is. Also, this will give, if some of you don't have the book, it will give you another week to get the book. You must get the book. This is, Ken Upanishad is, I believe, one of the first Upanishads that Gurudev had taken. So if you see the book, at least the book that I have, has a huge introduction, and I'm sure your books has it too. So there is basically 44 pages in my book. It's a very, very old edition, but 44 pages is introduction. So you can imagine Gurudev, you know, when he first started, he would introduce the Upanishad in detail. Okay. So let us begin with a question. What is the most definite thing in this life? Most definite. Most. That definitely is going to happen. It is death. Okay. Everything else is a may or a may. It may happen or may not happen. Marriage may or may not. House may or may not. Job may or may not. Education may or not. Money may or may. Everything else is a may or may not. It may happen. It may not happen. But death. Death, you cannot say, nobody can say, I may die or I may not die. There hasn't been anybody like that. There will not be anybody who will be able to say that. And the saddest part of the whole thing is that this one most certain event of our life, nobody prepares us for it. You go to school, you go to college, they prepare you for a job. They prepare you for making money. They prepare you for arts and crafts and dance and sports and you name it, but not death. And therefore, this word is the most feared. Very many people. I very recently, in 1 week, I have heard of 3 deaths. And 93-year-old, extremely afraid to die. So it's a very fearful word, but yet no, and a very certain thing, certainty of life, but nobody teaches you. So our scriptures, our rishis, they developed what is known as the prasthana trayi, prasthana departure, because death is a departure. It's a departure from this world. Whether it will be a departure into the next world or where it will be, that's up to us to decide what we want. But it's a departure. And to prepare us for that departure, they have a threefold prong or three aspects that they tell us to deal with this certainty of life. One aspect is the Bhagavad Gita, which we have been studying. The second aspect is the Upanishads. Trai is like a triangle, three. So the three-pronged approach to this certainty of life, one is the Bhagavad Gita, second is the Upanishad, and third is the Brahma Sutras. Out of these three, Bhagavad Gita we can relate to the most. And the reason is that the student of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjun, as we have already seen, is somebody like us. He's a householder, he has likes and dislikes, he has got wealth, he has enjoyed life, etc., etc., etc. So when we relate to the student, we can also relate to the teaching, because the student is like us, and so the teacher is speaking to him, and all what is being spoken at some stage or at most of the stages, that applies to me. That applies to me. That applies to me. So when you relate to the student, you automatically relate to the teaching. And therefore, Bhagavad Gita is the most popular, considered easy to understand. Okay. And written by a human being, Vedavyas. Bhagavan Vedavyas wrote it. Bhagavan Krishna spoke it. So it's written by a human. So you'll see that every verse, we've studied six chapters, has a meter. It is poetic, you know, because it is written by somebody, right? So it's thought about and written. So there is a meter, there is a grammar, there is all those kinds of things. The Brahma Sutras, on the other hand, they are also written by Bhagavan Vedavyasa. And there are 550 in number, and they are considered as the PhD, the highest in studies. Brahma Sutra, the purpose of Brahma Sutras is to resolve the seeming conflicts that appear in the Upanishads. So obviously, it is understood that if you want to take up a study of the Brahma Sutras, you must have studied at least the 10 major Upanishads. There are 108 Upanishads, we'll come to that. But the 10 major, because the purpose of writing Brahma Sutras by Bhagavan Vedavyasa was to resolve conflicts from the Upanishads. Now, if you don't even know what is the conflict in the Upanishad, how will you understand the Brahma Sutras? So to understand Brahma Sutras, or the qualification to start studying Brahma Sutras is you have to have studied 10 Upanishads. Okay? So that is the highest. When I say lowest, don't think that it's any lower than the Upanishads, because as we have seen, that Bhagavad Gita is an essence of all the teachings of the Upanishads. So it's not lower. What I mean by lower is easy to understand, easy to relate to, because the student is like us. So when the student is at our level, then the teaching also is at our level. And that's why it is easy. The Upanishad now is a part of the Vedas. And it is a Paurusheya. It is not written by any human being. None of the Upanishads, they all form. There are 108 known Upanishads. 10 of them are considered major. And they all form a part of the Vedas. Okay. So let us understand the Vedas a little bit. And then we'll come back into the Upanishads. Vedas, as most of you know, they're considered as the breath of the gods. Okay, so if they are the breath of the gods, they also have to be beginningless. Why? Because God is beginningless. That much we have heard. Bhagavan Sri Krishna also has said in Bhagavad Gita that I have no birth and I have no end, death, and neither do you. He's telling Arjun in second chapter, he has told that this Atma has no birth and no death. So if there is no birth and death for God, and we have to personify him as God, then obviously his breath has no birth and no death either. So Vedas are considered as the breath of the gods, and they are eternal. It is said that during the time of Pralaya, the Vedas go back into this avyakta, unmanifest, and when creation happens, they manifest. It's the same Vedas, they don't change. Okay, Vedas don't change. There are four Vedas, you must know that, Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, and Atharva Veda. People think that Rig Veda is the oldest, and then Yajur Veda, and then Sama, and then Atharva. Atharva is the latest. It's not like that. There's nothing latest and oldest. They're all the same. They are a They're known as a mantra rashi. Rashi, a whole storage, like a whole rashi is what? Collection. It's a huge collection of mantras. Now, the reason that they are called mantras, whereas when we studied Bhagavad Gita, we said shloka 1, shloka 2, verse 1, verse 2. As opposed to when we study the Upanishad, we would say mantra 1, mantra 2. And the reason is that shloka is man-made, mantra is a Purushya, not written by any mortal. So it's when it's not written by anything from the Vedas, therefore, comes to know, is known as a mantra. It is not a shloka. Okay? So sometimes Swamijis will say, oh, in Bhagavad Gita also they say mantra, but actually it is shloka. And this is mantra. Or when we are studying, I might also say next shloka, let's read next shloka. I might say it, but it is not. It is a mantra. Okay, every verse from the Veda is a mantra. Not only that, because it is not written by a human, you know, by a mortal, it will not have meter. Like some mantras will have meter, some mantras will not have any meter. It'll be like that. Now, when you read this Kenopanishad, you know, like it's the first, the Shanti part only is so huge, there is no meter. Whereas if you look at Bhagavad Gita, there is no verse, no shloka which does not have a meter. It has a fixed meter. Anything which is written by mortals will have a meter. That's the first thing you will notice, that there may be, may not be. Okay. The Vedas, they were, like I said, a collection. It was a mantra rashi, because you may have heard that, oh, Bhagavan Vedvyas wrote the Vedas. Now, understand that he didn't write it out of his mind. They were already there. What he did was he compiled them into four different parts. And those parts are known as Rigveda, Yajur, Sama and Atharva. Those parts. It's actually, there is not like a division. This is separate. This is not like that. It was a whole collection. And Bhagavan Vedvyas thought, previously, you know, in the olden days, it was only by Karna Parampara, what is known as Karna Year. So the teacher would recite and the disciple would repeat. And that's how the knowledge was passed from teacher to taught. But Bhagavan Vedvyas knew that when Kali Yuga comes, people are not going to have that sort of concentration of mind. And it is not going to be possible for people to just learn by listening. First of all, they're not going to have any time. We don't have time to listen to, you know, our own parents sometimes, right? What are we going to sit and listen to the Vedas? So there is no time. It's a fast food and fast everything. So Bhagavan Vedvyas thought, I better write this down, put this in writing. Then that way, at least that book is there. Then the person doesn't have to, you know, he can read over and over and over again. Whoever is interested can read again and again. Because when it's just being told, how many times the teacher will repeat? Because it's so many mantras. So that is why Bhagavan Vedvyas compiled them. He did not write them. Means, okay, he wrote them, but it's not his own original idea or anything. They were already there. And what he did was he took this mantra rashi, this collection of mantras, and he sort of divided them in four different categories. The Rig Veda is prose. It's in most of the mantras. If you see any Upanishad from the Rig Veda, because Veda itself, we may not have a chance to even see. Anybody who goes to Sandipani, please go in Bombay in the library. They have one Veda. It's like from there to there. They've kept it in a showcase. You know, this big, big book is there. So the mantras from the Rig Veda are mostly prose, but some of the mantras will have. It's not like prose means only prose. From right first to last mantra is only prose. Not like that. There'll be a bit predominantly they are in prose. Okay. The mantra is the Yajur Veda, Yajus. Yajur comes from Yajus. So the Yajus Veda, the mantras from the Yajur Veda are mostly to do with different worships. So they are in the form of poetry. They have a little bit of a rhythm, a rhyme. Again, there will be prose mantras in Yajur Veda also, but predominantly poetry. Samaveda is a Gita, Giti Pradhan Veda, it is called. Giti Pradhan means it can be sung. Means it has got a tune and meter and everything. So those mantras can be sung. And therefore, we have people who do Samagayana. And if you pay attention to the Gita Dhyana Shlokas, in one of the verses there, it says Samagayana is there. So they can be sung. Those mantras can be actually sung. And then Atharva Veda contains all the sciences that are required. So Ayurveda comes from Atharva Veda. Astrology comes from Atharva Veda. So these sciences that are required that we use in our day-to-day life, like not that we're using Ayurveda in a day, but you know, Ayurveda medicine is there. Astrology is there. That is coming from Atharva Veda. All of this is how that division was made by Bhagwan Ved Vyasa. From the originally whole collection, he culled them like this and he has done it. Now, the Upanishads, they form a part of these four Vedas. Among the four Vedas, there are these 108 Upanishads. And Upanishad is also, okay, before we go into Upanishad, now Vedas, what is in that mantra Rashi? What are the Vedas telling us? We should know a general idea of what is the content of the Veda. So Vedas talk about two things only, this whole mantra Rashi. One is Dharma and one is Brahma. These two things Vedas talk about, all the Vedas. Okay. They talk about, if you look at these two subjects, Dharma here doesn't mean religion, not Hindu Dharma and Christian and not that Dharma. Dharma here means a set of laws. Laws, that is the meaning of Dharma here. Now, what are the set of laws? If you go to any country, every country has its own constitution. Every country has its own set of laws, which is written down and which you should know. Like when you're driving, you should know the laws of the road. If you're flying, you should know the laws of the airport, like security. You have to go through security. So all these laws are there, which the government has made. Now you see, you go through US security, it's like, this thing. So, but the government has made it. It's all written down. We can read them. If we want to study the laws of the country, we can read the constitution. We can read the law. We can know that. But there are certain laws which are governing this entire universe. And those laws cannot, they're not written anywhere. We cannot read them. We cannot know them. They are laws beyond our senses. Atindriya Vishayaha Vedaha. That is the definition of Veda. What is Veda? What does Vedas tell us? They tell us the subjects which are Atindriya. Atindriya means which transcend the senses, which cannot be known by the senses. So this universal law, which is known as Dharma, we cannot know by the senses. And one example of this Dharma is the law of karma. We don't know. We know that there will be a result. We don't know why that result is coming to us. We don't know which action is giving us that particular result. Because of our studies, now we know there are so many people who don't even think like that. They think I did it and this thing happened. But we as spiritual seekers, we have heard it many times and we know that if something has come to me, a situation, and it could be a good or a bad situation, it is because of something that I have done in the past, either in this life or in the previous life. And that is something that I cannot know by my senses. And those are the type of universal laws that the Vedas deal with, which are beyond any topic. If it is to be known by the senses, Vedas are not. Vedas are not dealing with what to do with mutual funds, where to invest money. That doesn't fall under the purview of the Vedas. Okay. This universal constitution which is there. Okay. Why is the sun rising every single day? Why is the sun not saying, hey guys, I need a holiday on Saturday and Sunday? Why is the wind blowing all the time? Why is the fire giving heat all the time? Who is controlling them? What are the forces of nature? We don't know. We don't know that. Vedas talk about all this. Okay. And then they talk about Brahma. Brahma here means Brahman, means pure consciousness, means Bhagavan Shri Krishna, not in the form, please, but that supreme reality, which again can never be known through the senses. And so the topic of the Vedas is Dharma and Brahma, these two topics. When you live a life of Dharma, righteous life, follow the laws of the universe and accept them, then you become qualified for Brahma. That's why it's Dharma first, then Brahma. So unless you've led a life of Dharma, you cannot be qualified for Brahma. So the first thing to do is to lead a life of Dharma. Okay? So these are the two topics. Then, Upanishads are also known as Vedanta. You must have heard this word many, many times. We say, oh, there's a Vedantic lecture. Swamiji is coming, does that. And the literal meaning of Vedanta, the break is Veda, Anta, Anta end, Veda, Vedas. So end of the Vedas. And so generally in a Yajna format, if we were to do this, any Upanishad, then we were to say, oh, it's Vedanta. Then we say Upanishads come at the end of the Vedas, generally. That's what, for the general audience. But that is not necessarily true. It is not. If we see, when we go through other Upanishads, we will see that the Upanishads can come in any part of the Vedas. Okay, a little bit more about the Vedas. There are four Vedas and each Veda is divided into four parts. Okay, four Vedas divided into four parts. The first part of every Veda is known as the mantra portion. The second part is known as a Brahmana portion. The third part is known as the Aranyaka portion. And the fourth part is known as Vedanta. Okay, that's where the word comes from, Vedanta. So the last part is Vedanta. The first part is mantra. In between you have the Brahmana portion, which is also known as the Karmakandi portion. And that is the bulkiest portion of the Vedas. The maximum amount of mantras are in that Karmakandi portion. And then there is the Aranyaka, and then there is the Vedanta, which is the very end. And therefore, people think Upanishads is Vedanta, and therefore it is at the end of the Vedas. But it is not so. An Upanishad can appear in any one of these four parts. When we study Ishavasya, you will know it comes in the mantra portion of the Veda. Ishavasya comes in the mantra portion. Some come in the Brahmana portion. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the huge Upanishad, comes in the Aranyaka portion. It's not necessarily that it's at the end. But for general purposes, for the general public, we say, okay, that is the end of the Vedas. You know, it appears at the end of the Vedas. The mantra portion is meant for, it consists of all these mantras in praise of the deities. And the deities are the sun god, the rain god, the, you know. What it is previously, people thought that, oh, we cannot, and actually it is true. You cannot live without the sun. How the crops will grow, right? You cannot live without rain. How can the crops grow if there is no rain? So people thought they were the supreme. So they prayed to, we see in Bhagavat also that they were going to do this yajna for Indra, right? For the rains. And then Bhagavan Shri Krishna, to prove a point, he said, don't do. He's not the supreme lord. But people used to think he's the supreme. He's controlling the rains. And our life depends on the rains. So of course he's supreme. And Bhagavan said, no, I am supreme. He is not supreme. He is only my officer. But people thought means what? They were not as evolved. So the first portion, the mantra portion, it is also compared to the Brahmacharya or ashram. See, the four parts are compared to the four ashrams also. So in Brahmacharya ashram, you don't know. You don't know very much, right? You're in the student life. You're studying. You're learning. So people who were not as evolved, they thought, my God, I better pray to the Lord Sun. He is the greatest. Because if the sun doesn't come and the crops don't this thing, then there won't be any crop rain if it doesn't come. So they prayed so that the mantra portion has got these mantras in praise of the deities, of the cosmic deities. And it is like as if they are the highest, but they're not. They're not. Now, the next portion is Karmakanda, which is Brahmana portion, also called as Brahmana portion. That is compared to the householders. So it is compared to the Grihastha Ashram. And the reason is because in the Karmakanda portion, you will find rituals for every desire that you may have in this world. You want a spouse, there is a yajna. You want a child, you want a son, there is a yajna. If you want a daughter, there is a yajna. If you want rain, there is a yajna. If you want wealth, there is another yajna. If you want heavens, there is another yajna. So that's why that portion is very bulky. And in Grahastha Ashram, it is meant for fulfilling our desires, because Shruti understands, the scriptures understand that not everybody suddenly, everybody is not a Bhagwan Shankaracharya, that at 8 they are very dispassionate and, you know, Nachiketas, when you read Karopanishad, when we study, you'll see Nachiketas, extreme Vairagya. Not everybody is like that. They're not that evolved. People have desires. People have likes and dislikes. So what the Vedas say, what Shruti says is, okay, I'm giving you this Karmakanda portion. All the mantras, they're all rituals. In Karmakanda, it's all full of rituals. We see Dashrath, you know, King Dashrath doing that Putra Kameshti Yajna. That's how he got the 4 sons, right? Draupadi's father did that Yajna. Then in Kathopanishad, you will see that Nachiketas' father, he wanted to do this Agnihotra Karma, Agnihotra Yaga or Yajna, which gives you the heavens. So there are people, there are yajnas in that portion which will fulfill your desires in this world as well as in the next world, which is heaven. But they don't give liberation. Okay? The next portion, Aranyaka portion, is compared to the Vanaprastha portion. So Vanaprastha is when you have fulfilled all your duties in this life. Then previously people used to go to the forest. Somebody in India long time back had asked me. So she said to me that, you know, that there is this Vanaprastha and yeah, people, but there's no forest that we can go into. What is to be understood that we need not physically go into a forest, but our mind should become withdrawn from this world. Then we are in a forest of our own, in our own house. No need to go anywhere to for our, this thing for Vanaprastha. Prastha is, prasthan is departure. For the Vana, that's why that Vanaprastha word is there. You go into the forest. But we need not go to a forest or anything. But what we can do, it's when you go to the forest, then you're withdrawn from your house and household duties. Staying in the house, you withdraw yourself. And the Aranyaka portion is considered, it's the third stage, wherein you are supposed to start thinking, I did all these rituals and I, of course, they all gave me results and yeah, they fulfilled all my desires. Am I happy still? Do I feel fulfilled? Do I feel content? These are the sort of thoughts that will come in a mature mind. When the mind, if the mind has really matured after a certain of doing. And you might say that, oh, but nowadays who does yajnas? Please remember, when we work hard, you know, those 10 hours per day we are putting in the work, all that is yajna. All that is for fulfillment of desire. So it falls under this Karmakanda portion, all that, our job. We don't have to do that actual karma that, you know, that the Vedas talk about, but we are doing karma. We are doing actions. Any action which is done to fulfill our own desires, that falls under this Karmakanda portion. It may not exactly be that yajna we are doing, but we are doing yajna. Okay. Then in Vanaprastha, we are supposed to think that what happened. Now, if there is grace of the Lord or Guru, you will enter Vedanta because you will think, no. I did all that. I am not yet fulfilled. I need this complete fulfillment. And how will I get it? I have to enter Sannyas Ashram. So this Vedanta is compared to the Sannyas Ashram. Not that we have to take orange robes. What it means, Sannyas means Samyak Nyasa, means giving up my false identity and trying to look for my real identity. Because all this time that I was doing all these rituals and all, I wanted to be a father, I wanted to be a mother, I wanted to be a spouse, I wanted money, I want comfort. All this was relating to the body, false identification. I want to give that up. That sannyas is in the mind, not orange robes. We do not have to take orange robes. We do not have to go to the ashram. No, in the mind that withdrawal has to come, that I have done all this karma and all, enough now. Now enough. Now I want to put my mind into Vedanta. And in that Vedanta portion are included all the Upanishads. But they are not physically at the end of the Vedas. They can come anywhere. And the reason they can come anywhere is because we have seekers like Nachiketas, who he was in the mantra portion. Okay, he was a brahmachari. He's an 8-year-old boy. So, but he is suddenly ready for this knowledge. So if the guru thought that doesn't matter, it doesn't, because age is not a qualification for Vedanta. Age is not. Mental preparation is what is required. The amount of dispassion that the mind has, and that person may be 8 years old. He may be 10 years old, 18, 80. That's fine too. So if the guru thought that this is a brahmachari and he's a young kid, but he's ready for this knowledge, the guru will give it out immediately. So Nachiketa's immediate realization at that age. Okay. But the person may have not had that maturity at that time, but he went into Grahastashram and then he had the maturity. Okay, fine. You don't have to do Vanaprastha. Understand that liberation can be gotten from any four stages. From Brahmachari, Grahastha, we see King Janaka. Example is King Janaka. He's the only one who's mentioned in Bhagavad Gita. He was a king, he was a father, he was an administrator, he was a kshatriya, but he was realized. And he had realized through Karma Yoga. That's why his name is mentioned in the third chapter in Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavan Sri Krishna mentions it. Janaka. That's for Bhagavan to take his name must be great, right? So in Grahasthashram also, if you are ready to get the knowledge, it will be imparted at whatever stage. Then Aranyaka. So we see Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the Yajnavalkya Rishi. He was a householder. He had two wives. He had a rich ashram. He was very rich because he was very knowledgeable. And he would go to the king. You know, the kings would have these debates. And then in the debate, people would not debate on ordinary matters, on matters of Brahma. Atindriya Vishaya, they would debate on, right? And whoever won would get. So if you've seen that episode from Upanishad Ganga, he goes, he wins, he gets 1,000 cows with 1,000 swarna mudra, means gold coins. Each, he gets 1,000 coins, and each cow had 1,000 coins around the neck, gold coins. That much wealth he brings home, right? But after that, he says that, no, I need something more. I need to get rid of my anger, because he had gotten very angry over there. And if you remember, he actually, the other opponent in anger, he says, if whoever loses has to lose his life, and his opponent had to give up his life. So he says, this is not good. So what he does, then he wants to leave everything and go. So his out of the two wives, one wife was very material minded, the younger one. So she said, what is wrong with you? We've got so much wealth. We've got so many cows. There are so many students. They're learning. They're respecting you. This, that. Why do you want to leave all this? But the older wife, she has, Maitreyi has the maturity to understand that if my husband is leaving all this and going, that means how great must that knowledge be? If he's leaving all the comforts of home and, you know, disciples who are respecting him so much money, wealth we have, grains we have, there is no worries, and he's leaving all this. So she asks, she has the maturity. She asks, because when they are married and if they want to really go away, they need the wife's permission. So when he asks permission, he says, I've divided the wealth among the two of you and you guys will be happy for the rest of your life. You don't have to worry. You don't have to work. And I'm going. And then she says, wait a minute. Why are you going? What is that is prompting you to leave all that? That must be greater than this. That much she understands. So she says, no, you tell me first. Before I give you permission, you tell me what are you going after. Then he instructs her in Vedanta, in this Vedantic knowledge. And that's why that appears in Dharanakanda. And then she says, why do I need this wealth for then? I'm also coming with you. So she also goes with you. So it can come in the Aranyaka portion, the Upanishad. And then finally, of course, in the Vedanta portion, it will also come. So Vedanta, actually, the literal meaning is end of the Veda. But what it means is the knowledge ends there. There is nothing more remains to be known. That is the actual meaning of Vedanta. End. It is the end of all knowledges. There remains nothing else to be known. Okay, and that's why this Vedanta, that's why Vedanta, and that's why Upanishad is known as Vedanta, because once you study the Upanishads, you are supposed to get realization, not necessarily, but at least you get parokshnan, at least you get indirect knowledge of what this is. Because the Upanishads, now you will see that their language is different, their teaching is different. It is not going to be like Bhagavad Gita. Okay? So Vedas, we said, was a Purusheya. Okay? I don't know if anybody thought about it, but if the question has arisen in your minds, why is it a Purusheya? Why do you say it is not written by any mortal? First thing is, I told you the subject matter of the Vedas is something which is beyond the senses. A human being can only write what is within the purview of his senses. Right? He can imagine, like, long before man landed on the moon, there was somebody in Europe, a scientist, who had actually written how it can be done. Okay? But even that was not beyond the purview of his intellect. He used his intellect. He used his senses to say that, okay, the moon is there and, you know, there's no gravity. And if this is done and if that is done, then we can reach the moon. In the 50s, it was written. Please understand, NASA went into much later, but it was already written. But nevertheless, it wasn't a subject matter beyond the senses. It was within the purview of the intellect, not the mind, but the intellect. Because if you remember Tattva Bodh, mind will go into the realm which are already known. Intellect goes into realms which are not known. But still, it is within the purview of the senses. So if anything is written by a human being, it has to be within the purview of the senses. But Vedas, the Vishaya, the subject itself, is beyond the purview of the senses. So how anybody can write it? Okay, one reason. Second is, it is so huge. It is, that's why I told you in Sandeepani, if you go to Bombay, you see that book, you know, that book means if you look, you have to look like this. Your head will go 180 degrees just to look, forget reading it. And this thick. And it's kept open and in this thing, you know. So if you were to read like these, it's so huge. How a limited, finite human being can write that? It's mind-boggling. Third thing is, totally flawless. There is no flaw. There is no error. There is no grammatical error. There is no spelling. There's no nothing, no error. Actually, Panini, Ashtadhyayi, Panini wrote the grammar rules reading the Vedas. He read the Vedas and from there he culled these 1,000, you know, sutras, more than 1,800, I think, Ashtadhyayi sutras, that this is the grammar rule, this is the grammar. It is not that Vedas were written based on his grammar rules. No, his grammar rules are based on the Vedas. And there are some things in the Vedas which even he couldn't explain. He cannot explain the grammar in that, what grammar is used. But that is not wrong. We cannot understand it. So it is known as Arsha Prayog. There will be some things in the Vedas, some mantra, when you read Rudra and all, but that is wrong. Or we think, oh, that should be Rasva and that should be Dirgha and all. But those rules do not apply to the Vedas. It's called as Arsha Prayog. It's flawless. Any composition by a human being, it cannot be flawless. Because the human being is limited. He's limited. His senses are limited. Like eyes, you know, like we cannot see, I cannot see beyond the wall. What my eyes will see, infinite things can't. I cannot hear beyond a certain decibel. It has to be within 20 to 200 decibels. Otherwise, my ear cannot hear it. That's why animals have better hearing than us. That's why they heard the tsunami in Thailand, in Phuket, and they went up to the mountains. They have better hearing than us. We don't have that much hearing. We don't have that much eye power in the eyes. We don't have. So in our senses only, we don't have any that kind of unlimited power. How we can write about something which is beyond the senses? You know, so it is not possible. And then there can be inadvertence, carelessness, laziness where we are concerned. So we are bound to make mistakes. Okay? So that's why there if we say that there is absolutely no flaw in something, then that's one of the reasons that we say that mortals could not have written the Vedas. Okay, unlimited knowledge beyond the senses, and yeah, flawless. Okay, and yeah, they're so vast. So that is why we say that they are a Purusheya. They are known as a Purusheya, not written by any human. All right. Now, let us come to the word Upanishad itself. I told you there are 108 and there are 10 major Upanishads. Now, why do we call 10 of them major and the other minor? So obviously the others are minor Upanishads. One distinction, common distinction is that, see, Bhagavan Shankaracharya in his short lifespan has written commentaries on 10 Upanishads. So the most common reason that they give is that since Bhagavan has chosen to comment on these 10, they are major, the rest are minor. That's one general thing, because he wrote 10. Kenopanishad that we are studying is one of probably his favorite ones, must be. He wrote two commentaries, not one. He wrote one, then he was not very happy with it, so he wrote another one. Take your pick. So that is one reason. But another reason is that there are these major Upanishads. There are three questions I've always told you, even when we studied Bhagavad Gita, that there are these three aspects in Vedanta that we have to think about. One is who? Me, myself, moi, I, the subject, right? Then I, the subject, look around and see the world. And I, the subject, know that I did not create the world. Right? Because the world was already there when I was born, and I've seen many, many deaths happening, and the world is happily continuing. That means even after I die, nothing will happen to the world. It will happily continue. So the question, third question arises is, I am here, I see the world, then who created? And I did not create the world, then who created the world? So I, creation, Jagat, and then creator, Ishvara. So I, the Jiva, Jagat, this world, and then Ishvara. So there is this three entities that we have questions about. What is this world? Who created the world? Who am I? In a mature mind, only these things. Otherwise, if you ask anybody, who am I? They'll give you a long list of adjectives. I am a mother, father, PhD, doctor, engineer, this, that, blah, 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 blah. All that is adjectives that always anybody can give. But if you really ask, who are you? They really don't know who they are. So those three questions, when an Upanishad deals with all three, it is known as a major Upanishad. And when the Upanishad, there are some small Upanishads, they deal only with one aspect of it. So to give you an example, if you have heard the name of Amrita Bindu Upanishad, now we have the book also by Guruji, I think. Guruji's commentary is there. That Amrita Bindu Upanishad deals with the mind. Okay? Any topic that is dealt with, please understand, it is from the Veda only, and it deals only with the mind. Or there is one even tinier Upanishad called Sharirika Upanishad. So this Sharirika Upanishad, as according to its name, deals with Sharira, with the body. And every Upanishad will then tell you, it tells you in detail how the body is, very, very detailed. And then it says, think now, can you be this filth? So that's why it always point to the highest. But then it doesn't talk about creation and stuff. So that is the kind of broad distinction between major and minor. But people find it easy if Bhagavan has commented, okay, major. And the 10 Upanishads that he has commented upon is, of course, the Kena Upanishad, Katha Upanishad, Ishavasya Upanishad, Mundaka Upanishad, Mandukya Upanishad, Aitareya, Taitareya, Prashna Upanishad, Chandogya Upanishad, and Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So these are the 10 Upanishads which are considered to be major. The rest of them are considered to be minor. Okay? All right. Now, the word itself, Upanishad. So when we say Upanishad, there are three syllables in that, Upa, Ni, and Sad. Okay? And the verbal root, because Upa means it's a prefix. you have heard the word upasana. Upa means going near. So upasana is asana, upa asana, so sitting near. And that is what is when we say worship, we are sitting near God and then doing a puja. So that is called as upasana. This is upa, so near. Ni stands for nishchayatmak buddhi. Nishchayatmak buddhi means firm determination. So I go with firm determination near a teacher. Okay, why should I go to a teacher? That is explained by the word sad, by the verbal, and the verbal root is, the root is shardali dhatu, and this shardali dhatu has got three meanings. One is to loosen, one is to destroy, and the third one is known as gati. Gati is movement, speed. Okay, these are the three meanings of this word sad. So Bhagavan Shankaracharya, in his commentary, he says that generally, okay, we have not done Upanishad. So let me tell you a little bit of a commentary. You know, the bhashya, when we say the bhashya, to write a bhashya, the one who is writing it is known as bhashyakar. And Bhagavan Shankaracharya is known as Bhagwan Bhashyakar, because there is no other greater commentator than him. He has written Bhashya on Bhagavad Gita, 10 Upanishads and the Brahma Sutras. Okay. So if you hear the word Bhagwan Bhashyakar, then know that it's Bhagwan Shankaracharya is being referred to, because nobody will take his name, you know, because it's very respectful personality. So they'll say Bhagwan Bhashyakar. Now this Bhashyakar has rules, not like anybody can go and comment. And the rules of this Bhashya are that every word, they have to give the verbal root of that word. Okay. In Sanskrit, every word has a verbal root, and that most of the roots have multiple meanings. That is the problem. Means not a problem, but problem for us. So when there is multiple roots and one root, but multiple meanings, the word can assume multiple meanings as per that meaning of that root. And then, so the Bhashyakar, the commentator, it's his responsibility to actually point out that in every word, what is the root? Then the meaning, how many meanings of that root are there? And then which meaning he is taking for that particular mantra or shloka, and not only which meaning he's taking, but why he's taking that meaning and why he's not taking the other meaning. This is the responsibility of the Bhashyakar. It's not an easy task. It's not an easy task at all. So to know the verbal root of every word, cannot omit a single word, single, even two word, like two meaning has to be given. Why that two is there? What does it mean? Why does it mean? And then every single word. Right. So that means how much grammar he must have known, because he has to know the meaning of all the words, all the meanings. And therefore the meaning, there'll be multiple meanings for one word. And that is why it is recommended that we do not read Upanishads on our own, because we will misunderstand the meaning. Even if we know the grammar, we may not understand which exactly meaning to take. This point will become extremely clear when we study Kathopanishad, because in Kathopanishad, I'll give you a simple example. The word Purusha, Atma, it has also three meanings, but I think it's Purusha word or Atma, one of the two words, Atma maybe. In one mantra, it means the senses. Now think about it. When I say Atma, you're thinking Paramatma, right? But in Kathopanishad, we will explain to you, Bhagwan has explained why he takes the word, the meaning of Atma as senses in that word. Next mantra, it is mind. It means mind. Next mantra, it means intellect. And the fourth mantra, it means the supreme reality. And he has explained why. Because this word Atma also has got multiple meanings. So that's why to understand each word in its correct import, we need a teacher. That is the reason that they say that Vedanta scriptures should not be studied without the guidance of the teacher. Therefore, when we say upa, when we say going near, it means not going near a book or a DVD or a CD, but going near a live human being, a teacher, a spiritual teacher, a master, actually, one who has himself realized the self, like our Pooja Gurudev. Okay, so now, upa, going near, ni, nishayatmak buddhi, that is the meaning of ni, sad, I told you there are three meanings, sardali dhatu, loosen, destroy, movement. Bhagwan says that when you go near a teacher, we can take the word meaning loosen because it loosens the bondage of sansara. What is the bondage of sansara that we have? Likes and dislikes, right? What is keeping us bound to this sansara is our likes and dislikes. That's why we saw in Bhagavad Gita how important Bhagwan talks over and over again about this samatha, samabuddhi, right? Equanimous in likes and dissolve the like. Karma yoga, the whole karma yoga is to dissolve likes and dislikes. And therefore, sardali dhatu, when it means loosen, yes, you go near a teacher with a determined mind. Why? Because this is not an easy study. Study of the Upanishads is not easy. Study of Vedanta itself is not easy. Kathopinishad again will say, that's why I was saying Kathopinishad you should do first. Kathopinishad will say, it is like walking on a razor's edge. It says, it actually says, Shurasya Dhara. It's like walking on a razor's edge. It's not easy. Imagine to walk on a razor, on a sword, the sharp end of the sword, right? So it is like that. So this studies, therefore it requires a determined mind. Because if you don't have that determination, you will not go further in it. Because it's difficult. It's not easy. So with the determined mind, when you go, he will loosen, the teacher will loosen this bondage of sansara. Means he will help you dissipate your likes and dislikes. And that will loosen this. And what is the bondage? Birth and rebirth, huh? Because you might think, I'm not bound. I'm free to do anything. I go here. I go there. I can do whatever that I like. That itself is bondage. The fact that I can do that notion that I can do whatever that I like, it's bondage because it's binding you to birth again. And Kathopanishad will say, they go from death to death, not even birth to birth. Death. Yeah, Lord Yama says, in this web of likes and dislikes, the jiva goes from death to death to death. And he doesn't even know that. So it loosens. Next is destruction. The word, the meaning is destruction. It destroys ignorance. What is our primordial ignorance? That I am this body. That thought itself is ignorance. That I am not, Vedas say, I'm not the body. I'm not the mind. I'm not the intellect. I am that supreme self. So when I go on thinking that I am the body or I go on thinking that I'm jiva, that is ignorance. And that ignorance is removed by this Upanishad. And third is gati. Gati is, I told you, movement. So the seeker's movement towards this higher evolution is accelerated. It accelerates our movement towards liberation. And therefore, all three meanings in the word Upanishad apply. And therefore, this word Upanishad itself means knowledge. It doesn't mean a book. Understand that when we say open, we say, of course, this book is Keno Upanishad. But actually, what it is it's actual, it is the real knowledge. It is actual knowledge. And therefore, Bhagwan says that Upanishad must be taken very seriously. It is knowledge itself. Okay. Now, next one. So when we look in this world, why should we study Upanishad? Why? That is also there, right? Why? So when you look in this world, you see two types of beings, sentient, insentient. Okay, that's very simple. There's the inert world, the material world, and then there is the live world. And in the live world, we see four types of classifications. One is the humans, animals, plants, and stone is this, or birds. Four, if you say, humans, animals, birds, reptiles, all kinds of beings, and then plants. And then the inert world is the stones and the minerals, etc. But we are not talking about inert. This knowledge is not meant for inert world. It is only meant for the live people. Now, not meant for plants either. They do not have that intellect to understand. Animals also, It does not apply to animals because this knowledge requires a very subtle intellect, which the animals do not have. Okay, there are four things which are common between humans and animals. Ahar, food, they eat, we eat. Bhaya, fear, they have fear, we have fear. Sleep, nidra, they sleep, we sleep. And maithunam, sexual activity. These are the four things which are common between humans and animals. Now, if we do only these four things, which most of us do, like we eat, we earn so that we can eat, we sleep. Nobody says, I don't sleep, I work all night. We sleep. We have fear. We have security. We have security alarms. We have these, that. People feel secure when they have a bank balance, when they have a job, when they have a spouse, when they have a house. So security and then progeny. So if we do only these four things, then where is the difference between an animal and us? That part is to be thought about. So maybe there is something more that we have got this human body. Maybe there is something more that we should do with it. Okay. Now, with animals, they do not have a choice but to do these four things. It's like, you know, if a mother has four children, then of course the first one is quite old, and then the second, third, and then there is a baby, then that mother is looking after the baby the most. Isn't it? The mother only will make sure that the baby is fed at the right time. The older one will say, okay, the food is in the fridge. You can take, you have a choice. You eat this or that. You warm it up, you eat. But the baby, she doesn't say. She says, no, this is what you get fed. This is the time. This is the time you sleep. So this is what happens with us and the animals. Mother nature knows that animals are not that well. They don't have that type of intellect. So she takes care of them. That's why she programs them. How does Mother Nature take care of animals? They are programmed. So you will see that when an animal, only when he's hungry, he will eat. Even lion, if the lion is not hungry, lion and deer are roaming around together. I think you guys went to Africa. Guruji was telling us that in that camp in Africa, there was a prey, and then first the lion came and then he ate. And then some other animal came and then they ate. Then some third one came. And then finally the vultures came. So even in the animals, there is a discipline. Nobody touched that kill until the king of the jungle came. Lion. I think Lata was there. This is what I heard from Guruji. Yeah? He said, we saw that. We saw, and then nobody touched until the lion and his family came. They ate, they went. Then some other thing came. They ate, they went. And last came the vultures. So even in them, so there is a total programming by Mother Nature. So they will sleep at a particular time, like, a cow, she'll be always vegetarian. She will not think that, oh, you know, I'm anemic. Maybe I should have some eggs and maybe I should have some meat and non-veg. And she will never think. She will go on eating grass only. Whether she'll become, if elephant doesn't think, oh, I'm becoming too fat. Maybe I should eat less and reduce some weight. They don't think like, they cannot think. They're programmed. So they will eat, they will sleep at a particular time. They'll mate at a particular time. They have no control. They live on instinct and impulse. Whereas Mother Nature has given us the control. So we can eat more, we can eat less. I'm a nurse. I know I have to go on night duty. I will sleep during the day. I have control, right? I have control over my mating. It's not like there's a mating season. I will not mate in public. I will not do things which are not kosher, right? We have securities. I relieve that security, right? I mean, relieve in the sense, relieve the fear rather, with alarms and this and that and all. So the idea is that the humans have been given more control because they have the intellect to exercise the correct control. If I am putting on too much weight, I have the control to control my eating. If I have to have night duty or if I have to go pick somebody at the airport at night, then I try and take rest in the afternoon, like that, okay? And because the humans are the ones, another thing with human and animal is horizontal. So the head, the heart, the stomach, and the genitals are in one line. So equal importance to all four as opposed to us, where the head is first, then heart, then stomach, then genitals. And that is how the importance should be. Thinking first, then heart, emotions, then you worry about your belly, then last, the sexual activity. Okay? And because we have been given this subtle intellect, we can understand this subtle topic, which is beyond the senses. Why? What is the difference between subtle and gross? Gross is that which can be known by the senses. That is all gross knowledge. You know how to run the computer, car, cook, mutual funds, this, that, banking. That is all gross. It is by the senses. But this knowledge is something beyond the senses. So for this knowledge, a gross intellect is not useful. It is the subtle intellect which has to be sharpened. And I've told you this before in Bhagavad Gita. How do I touch the intellect? How do I make it subtle? By purifying the mind. Okay? So we have studied Karma Yoga and everything. Next Monday, we will go into the verses proper for this. It is a very interesting Upanishad. It starts off with the highest knowledge. And what it does is, towards the end, at the last portion of this Upanishad, there's a little story, beautiful story. Okay? And why is the story? The story is for those who are not as evolved. So the gist of the story is exactly what is told in the first part. It's similar to Bhagavad Gita, where Bhagavan starts at the highest knowledge and then just comes down, down, down. It's the same thing. The Upanishad will start at the highest knowledge and then it comes down to a story. So if you didn't follow what was in the first earlier portion, then follow it through that story. That is the idea of this Upanishad, okay? Kena Upanishad. Kena. By what? And it begins with the question. Of course, the first Shanti Mantra is there. So next week, we'll study the Shanti Mantra and go into the verses if time permits. And after that, then we should all chant. So we should chant this, the Shanti Mantra. Now, one thing, if any one of you has got because I have a very old edition. So when you have the new edition, do you have the first verse, Om Sahana Bhavatu? Can you check? But I need a latest edition. This one is an old edition. And you have the same one as I do, Abhimanyu. We are old. But who has got the new? Yeah, probably that one is new. I don't know. Is it new? Did you just buy it? Does it start with Om Sahana Bhavatu on page 45? Or does it start with Om Apya Yantu Mamangani? Unmute yourself. Om Sahana Bhavatu. Sahana Bhavatu.
45
page. Om Sahana Bhavatu.
Yeah, and then Om.
47. Om Apyayantu. Perfect. Okay. All right. Great. So next week we will meet again at 6:30. I have introduced the Upanishad enough. If there are any questions about it, or even now, if you have any questions, please ask, or you can email me, or you can ask me next time. But we will go into the text proper, okay? Because it was the first Upanishad, it is necessary to have that sort of an introduction to it. Any questions? All clear? Okay. All right, then. I'll see you next Monday. All right. Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnami